Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to talk about sleep can strengthen your long-term memories in the immune system. This is from a major university in Germany. Also, chances are your body is already contaminated with cancer-causing glyphosate. We'll take a look at that dangerous pesticide. And a farmer finds surprising results when he sends GMO crop dust. Dust, by the way, is what we call dirt in a farm, and it seems to be everywhere. And dietary restrictions help maintain circadian rhythms. That's important, especially concerning cancer. And a whole lot more on health and healing. Then my guest in the second part of our program is Alex Baden-Mayer. Alex is an activist serving as the political director for the Organic Consumers Organization, and she's co-editor of the Organic Consumers Organization's major magazine, Organic Bites. We're going to talk about investigating Monsanto for crimes against nature and humanity. A lot going on there. Also today, former President Jimmy Carter speaks out about Israel and his views on apartheid. Then the CDC whistleblower admits the MMR vaccine, the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine, causes autism. And then we're going to talk about being lied to about Fukushima. It's a ticking time bomb. Dr. Michio Kaku will give those insights. And then we're also going to look at a discussion from Chris Hedges. Chris Hedges sits down. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning author. And he sits down in the Toronto Vice office to discuss what it takes to be a rebel in modern times. So that's important. Also today, I'll be touching upon topics such as the number of people who've died because of American medicine in the last 15 years. Also, the FDA has known that processed meat, you know, bologna, salami, causes cancer for over 40 years. Yet they continue to cover it up to protect the meat industry. Also, Tylenol. Tylenol during pregnancy is associated with autism increase, according to a Danish study. And the 20th largest bank in the world, which means it's a large, large bank, says that this year we're going to end up with a cataclysmic year and investors should be afraid. Mike Snyder of Economic Collapse will give us the latest on that. Also, if time permits today, if not on another show, I'll share what Vincent Emmanuel has to say. He says he helped create ISIS. How so? Well, I'll say that for you. Let's begin. I've mentioned many times that we need sleep. We need quality sleep, and preferably we need a nap. A short nap doesn't have to be very long. In the afternoon at any time, just a 20-minute nap can knock about 2 hours off our required sleep, but it also re-energizes us and gives us more energy for the, let's say, the latter part of the day and in the evening. But it does something more. According to this University of Tübingen in Germany, an article published in Trends in Neuroscience, for more than a century, scientists demonstrated that sleep supports the retention of memories of facts and events, meaning the better the night's sleep, the more likely you are to remember things, which is interesting because think how many college students cram for exams by staying up all night and hence are sleep deprived, lessening the opportunity for them to recall. Whereas if they get a good night's sleep, they would have better recall. And later studies have shown that slow wave sleep, now that's referred to as deep sleep, is important for transforming fragile, recently formed memories into stable, long-term memories. And in this article, they show how that works and also how deep sleep, where you're really relaxed, actually strengthens your immunological memories of previously encountered pathogens. Quote, while it has been known for a long time that sleep supports long-term memory formation in the psychological domain, the idea that long-term memory formation is a function of sleep effective in all orgasmic systems is, in our view, entirely new. So that's good. So what happens in lay language, in case it's confusing, is that your immune system remembers an encounter with a bacteria or a virus by collecting fragments from that bug to create memory T cells, which last for years to help the body recognize a previous infection and quickly respond. And these memory T cells appear to abstract what is called GIST, G-I-S-T, information about the pathogens, as only T cells that store information about the tiniest fragments ever elicit a response. So studies in humans have shown that long-term increases in memory T cells are associated with a deep, slow-wave sleep on the nights that we need it. So in lay language, let's say that in the normal course of days, you're going to come into contact with bacteria and viruses. If you've had a good night's sleep, your T cells, a part of your immune system, will recognize it, will tag it, will remember it, and then be able to keep this from happening again by killing them. As a result, you stay healthier. Whereas if you work night shift, if you regularly work a night shift, you can knock about 8 years off your lifespan. If you're highly stressed, aside from that night shift, you can knock about another 7 to 10 years off your lifespan. If you're overweight for most of your life, if you're not exercising regularly, if you're more sedentary, you can knock more years off your life. That's why we have such a short average lifespan, because people who don't, who get a good night's sleep, who deal with stress in a more appropriate manner, who exercise, who eat right, they're the ones living the long side of that equation, everyone else living on the short side of the equation, so then they take the two numbers, the longest and the shortest, they come up with an average. But getting a good night's sleep means your immune system is stronger. You'll be able to deal with bacteria and viruses easier. Now, I'm concerned about our environment. I'm concerned because our USDA has abrogated its responsibility to stop pollution that can impact our lives. They can't even stop the honeybee from being decimated. Half of all honeybees have been killed in the last 10 years because of the neonicotinoids. These are pesticides. And if they can't stop that because it would take away profits from the pesticide companies, then they're not going to look at the human condition because it's far more volatile politically and economically. You get a lot of lawsuits. You have modern-day love canals. So here's the deal. According to Jennifer Ray Reynolds in Natural News, chances are your body is already contaminated with cancer-causing glyphosate. How so? The briefings put forth by Friends of the Earth bring to light studies, quality studies, that have been conducted which prove the existence of glyphosate in human bodies. One is titled Human Contamination by Glyphosate, mentions that 60% of farmers, after the chemical had been applied, were found to have detectable amounts of the cancer-causing chemical in their systems. Even days after the application, farmers were still found to have glyphosate in their bodies. In fact, 80% of children's urine samples contain glyphosate. This was an important study that found glyphosate was found in women about to have surgery. And in an Iowa study, it was detected in the urine of both farming and non-farming families, including 80% of the children. So it's serious. And it's time that we banned glyphosate. And there's one more study here today. So most people are not aware that it's in the dirt. So it should come as no surprise that crop dust, that is, dirt and other contaminants that accumulate mostly during harvest season, is full of some questionable ingredients. What one farmer found when he sent some dust from his hog building outside his brother and father's farms where they grow, Roundup Ready corn. And the farmer collected some dust from the corners of the building where he housed his pigs and sent it to a lab, simply labeling it hog dust. And here is, quote, it says, total mole count 14,000, CFU, G's 7,200,000, and 15,600,000. And the mold found in the hog dust can cause everything from allergies to more serious diseases, including Aspergillus. In fact, there's a lot of Aspergillus in here. And so a lot of people are not aware that farmers using non-organic techniques can end up with Aspergillus that can cause asthma, viruses, pneumonia. And these contaminants are also known to reduce beneficial fungi in the soil, which means that crops grown in such toxic dust are not as nutritious or vital as we were told. One more reason to do biodynamic or sustainable organic gardening. Then you don't have to worry about that. A good study from the Huntsman Cancer Institute took a look at men, 40 men and women. They found that dietary restrictions help maintain circadian rhythms. And that's good, because when you have good, healthy circadian rhythms, you're less likely to have cancers. So one more reason to restrict refined carbohydrates, restrict meat, restrict sugars, restrict caffeine, and eat a healthy plant-based diet. Another study confirms eating an organic diet lowers pesticide levels in children. And this was from the Center for Environmental Research and Children's Health, shows that children, quote, especially those in low-income and agricultural families who switch to an organic diet, reduce their body's levels of pesticides. And this California study is one of the several ones that documents the benefits of eating an organic diet, especially for children who are especially vulnerable to pesticide exposure due to the developing bodies. The study, entitled Effect of Organic Diet Intervention on Pesticide Exposures in Young Children Living in Low-Income Urban and Agricultural Communities, follows these children ages 3 to 6, and for a period of time, and then they ended up with 23 different pesticide metabolites. These are the organophosphates. And these are very serious, including 2,4-D. They cause cancer. They cause all forms of destruction to the DNA. So switch over to organic, and it makes the big difference. Not long ago, I was filming down in New Orleans, and I was filming on a block that had been devastated by Hurricane Katrina, and the vast majority of the Lower Ninth Ward, where the government came in and spent, I believe it was around $40 billion, with a B, billion dollars, to raise the levee, a small amount, as it turns out, but to fix it where it had been breached. But the actual people living behind that levee, they weren't given any help. I saw trees that were uprooted. I saw a car that was upside down. You could see the watermark at like the 8 to 9 foot level on all the houses in that whole area. And I walked up and down each street looking for people I could speak with. And I came across a group who were tending to a garden. Now, there was no electricity. It didn't stop them. They went ahead and built passive, meaning no electricity, greenhouses. Just visualize a Quonset hut, or a hut that you might drive a little car into. It had a frame, and over that was stretched plastic. It was 44 degrees outside, but when you walked inside, it was around 80 degrees. And they put bales of hay around the whole structure up to about 4 feet, and so the hay acted as an insulating factor. And they were growing sprouts in there. And then outside, they had all these raised beds, and then there was a house, and it was one of the neatest things you've ever seen. From the outside, it looked a mess. But you walk in the door, there was no floor. It was a dirt floor. But everything was very neat. And they had all these beds lined up and some work tables and desks. And they had a school there. Homeless people lived there. And they were responsible to keep their space clean and neat. And it was all these young teenagers, 13 to 17 years old. And so I told them that I was doing a documentary on poverty in America, and would they like to have their story told? And they said, yeah. So they came together, and we filmed them. And one of the kids said, when you hear about all the money that goes into a disaster area to help people, rarely do you go in to see, does it actually get to the people who need help? More often than not, it goes to contractors or goes to agencies. It doesn't filter down. And here he said, I could take you around every block down here, and you outside of one block where Brad Pitt and the Jimmy Carter group of Habitat for Humanity, where they built 8 or 9 houses, thousands of houses are just destroyed. And he said, only reason we're able to be here is because we became self-sufficient. And he said, what do you think a teenager is going to do when their mom has no money for food, has no money for gasoline or for public transportation, in effect is destitute? They're going to go to drugs. And he said, none of us here do drugs. We don't sell drugs. We don't take drugs. We eat organic. We teach classes on organic. We do composting and take it to stores and sell organic compost. And they get the compost by going to restaurants and taking all the food that is thrown away by a restaurant, and then they compost it. Really neat. And this small group of people really deserves some national recognition, because what they are doing, I think, is just so important. I was just so proud of them. And I told them, I'm going to get your message out. And indeed, I gave them a pretty good-sized segment within the documentary, Poverty, Inc. But they're surviving, and in fact, many of them are thriving. They're earning incomes. They're not getting rich, but they're earning incomes. And so their mamas are not destitute. They have a place to stay, and they have a real good sense of discipline, and there's no crime, and it's spreading. It's spreading to other streets where people say, well, can I do that too? And the answer is yes. So they're holding classes all the time. I just want to share that the next time any of you are down in New Orleans, go into the 9th lower ward, ask around, and you'll find the people who took over a backyard, a house, and turned it into an organic garden, greenhouses, classes, and they're open and sell their produce on Saturdays. And there was a long line of people waiting to buy the produce because they get good, fresh, locally grown organic produce at very reduced prices. So it's a win-win. Anyhow, I just wanted to share that because there's some good people doing good things, but here are teenagers who are aware of the dangers of pesticides, who can do a whole lecture on it. I just wished all American teenagers would know the power of an organic plant-based diet, see how much animals suffer, so therefore they don't participate in that, and start to get healthy, get off caffeine. One other thing, a good study from the University of Granada in Spain and Venezuela's major university and University of York in England found that choline, C-H-O-L-I-N-E, improves memory and attention. So for all you who are having problems with memory, I suggest 500 milligrams a day of choline. Now, I would also say 500 milligrams of inositol, I-N-O-S-T-O-L, inositol, 500 milligrams of both to improve memory and attention. And that might be good for any teenager who's having some attention problem. But I believe most kids' attention problems are multifactorial, including caffeine, which causes hyperagitation, and they're going to misdiagnose it as bipolar. Sleep deprivation, living with electromagnetic pulsing into their brain from their computers and cell phones and listening devices, and improper diet, vitamin D deficiency, B-complex deficiency, B12 deficiency, and even a really conscientious, good teacher has a lot of problem trying to compete with a malnourished, caffeine and sugar-addled youngster in class. I'm Gary Noll. We're going to take a break and come back. We have a lot to share with you. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome you. We have people all over the world. In fact, I'm out on the road filming today, filming in Canada, and some phenomenal insights. I wish you could be behind the camera listening to what people are saying on topics that we're not getting the truth from official sources because of fear of offending people, getting funding dried up, or being attacked. These are fearless people. You'll see what I'm talking about when the documentaries are completed. I'm going to go through several things rather quickly, and then we're going to hear from Jimmy Carter and then Chris Hedges, then our guest. From Michael Snyder, Economic Collapse, the Royal Bank of Scotland, that's a biggie, is telling clients that 2016 is going to be, quote, a cataclysmic year, and they should, quote, sell everything. Now, this sounds like something that you might hear from the Economic Collapse blog, but up until just recently, you would have never expected to get this kind of message from one of the 20 largest banks on the entire planet. Unfortunately, this is just another indication that a major global financial crisis has begun and that we're now entering a bear market. Bulls buy, bears sell. The collective market value of companies listed on the S&P, the Standard & Poor's 500, has dropped about $1.6 trillion just in the last 2 weeks. And panic is spreading like wildfire all over the globe. And of course, when the Royal Bank of Scotland comes out and openly says that, quote, investors should be afraid, end quote, that's not going to help matters. It just amazes me that the Royal Bank of Scotland is essentially saying the exact thing that I've been saying for, what, the last 7 years? So I've told the listeners many times that there are a lot of indicators out there. We are oversupplied with inventory. The commodities market is crashing. We have oil below that line that no one wants to go below, $30 a barrel. You have thousands of companies that are going broke in the energy sectors. You have millions, about 6 million people are going to be laid off in the next 12 months. And I've named you the companies, the number of employees, the amount of debt. And it's all about debt. The reason that a company is going to go broke and stop production is because they're not getting any more money. They can't pay back the money they have. And if they should be financing through bonds, their bondholders are going to take a bath. The banks don't want to give any more money to anything in any industry that poses a risk. So, once again, not everybody will be affected, but many people will. And with more and more industry leaving the United States because it cannot afford to operate here. More businesses closing. Just before I went on the road, my brother Stephen and I walked down Broadway, and we walked down Broadway and back up Amsterdam, and we counted how many businesses that had been there for a long time had closed recently. And just last year on the Upper West Side, a newspaper called the West Sider showed all the businesses, some had been there 30 and 40 years, closed. Who can afford $150 a square foot for a small store per square foot? You're looking for a tiny little store costing you $20,000 a month rent. Who can afford that? And the bigger stores, I know for a fact, because I asked what did the store rent for that had been up on Broadway at 86th Street. Oh, $3.5 million a year. $3.5 million? Only a bank or a drugstore could afford to be in that space. But the landlords don't care, and the landlords have the politicians in their pocket. They have manipulated the system to their advantage. But this is true all across America. So we're not paying attention to what's happening to the average person, especially if in our neighborhood is nice and our accommodations are fine, our standard of living is fine, we still can afford or can have access to restaurants, movie theaters, and clothing stores. But I'll show you ghost towns all over America that once were thriving and now are not. So it's happening. Quote from the Royal Bank of Scotland, sell everything except high-quality bonds, says Andrew Roberts this week. You know, as China collapses, and China won't collapse. Remember, China has spent trillions of dollars over the last 10 years building ghost cities, phantom cities. Nobody lives in the damn places. And there's over 120 of them. And some could accommodate 2 to 3 million people. So they have room for probably, I'm guesstimating, 200 million of its citizens. Worst case scenario, people could live there. So they can continue to provide food and housing, and they just have to drop the value of their currency even more, which will make the products they manufacture very easy to sell. And then we got to compete against that? Well, not a good idea. We'd like to believe that we have the best healthcare system in the world. We have one of the worst. We have the most expensive. This year, we will pass that $3.5 trillion mark in 1 year, just 1 year. Where does that money go? It's not going to prevent disease. It's not going to talk about what causes disease. Not a nickel is going to go to criticize the people who are causing disease. So where does it go? It goes to hospitals. It goes to the manufacturers of drugs. It goes to $100 for saline solution, salt water, that costs a dollar. It goes for $20 aspirin, one aspirin that costs 2 cents. They charge you $20. And we're not stopping it. The system is so corrupt, is so bound by greed and special interest that it cannot be changed. If we cared, we would have a universal healthcare system. But that's only the first part of it. The more serious part, from my perspective, is it doesn't work. Now, you can't tell someone who's going to be interested in your statement, are you really saving people's lives with mammography or chemotherapy? I thought chemotherapy was a carcinogen. It is. So how exactly does that work in helping the immune system? And then you look at the last 4,000 studies done on chemotherapy and you find it doesn't work, actually contributes to cancer. Here's the latest statistics. These are all official statistics. I'm holding off on clarifying one statistic. Now, this is for the last 14 years, 2000-2014. There's one I have not been able to fully qualify, but the number of deaths from chemotherapy is, they say, 16,043,274. I will say I cannot confirm that, but it's a big number. Iatrogenic deaths, 12,576,900. Hospital error deaths, 7,059,040. Drug-resistant tuberculosis deaths, 3,369,000. Bed sore deaths, 1,844,000. Hospital malnutrition deaths, meaning you didn't have malnutrition, went into hospital, and you died because of malnutrition in the hospital, 1,745,508 deaths. Adverse drug reaction deaths, 1,700,587. Medical error deaths, 1,572,240. Hospital infection deaths, meaning you didn't have the infection when you went in the hospital, you contracted the infection while in the hospital and died, 1,203,245 deaths. Deaths by people taking selective serotonin reuptake inhibiting drugs, those are your tranquilizers and antipsychotics, 641,720. Surgery-related preventable deaths, 513,384. Prescription drug deaths. These are properly prescribed drugs. It still killed 365,257 people. And then there's another three pages of deaths. You're looking at a humongous number of people dying who none of these people should have died. Now, mind you, this does not include anyone who died outside of a hospital, who died at home. These are just dying in hospital over 14 years. And if these numbers are even remotely accurate, even being ultra conservative, you're still looking at over 45 million deaths. And you say that you're the best and brightest and the smartest, and you must control the entire system and nobody can challenge you because you're succeeding. Succeeding at what? You killed 45 million people in 14 years. Something's wrong with this scenario. So, serious situation. More on this on upcoming programs. The FDA has known processed meat causes cancer since the 70s. Quote from Let Health Freedoms Ring. They're added to nearly every processed meat product sold in the U.S. today. Nitrites and other synthetic curing agents that the Food and Drug Administration says are safe to eat and are keeping our meat products from spoiling too quickly. But an investigation by researchers from the University of Wisconsin has uncovered that, despite years of denial, the FDA has known since at least the 1970s that nitrites cause cancer, and it continues to pander to the meat industry in allowing their use. Now, meat curing has been around forever, but the historical record showing that this process allowed ancient cultures to preserve meats for extended period of time, especially during periods of food scarcity. People didn't have refrigerators, remember, so they had to come up with novel ways of food preservation that would get them through harsh weather conditions and other volatile environmental factors. Well, the fact that people have been curing meat since time immemorial isn't necessarily a problem. Salt, after all, is a natural curing agent and in and of itself isn't harmful. It's when salt is transformed through synthetic chemical alteration, in this case as nitrites, that it becomes harmful. And these same nitrites, according to independent scientists, have been the subject of intense debate over the years concerning their safety. So sodium nitrite is linked to leukemia, and it's the most popular curing chemical found in processed meats, bologna, salami, hams, and it's been approved for over 40 years, and it's been associated with leukemia and other forms of cancer. So Naturally occurring nitrites are not harmful. Not all, you know, it's not all bad. Not to be confused with naturally occurring nitrites, which aid in the body's normal regulation of blood pressure and immune response, and more synthetic, underline, synthetic nitrites are just the opposite. They damage the normal function of hemoglobin and can cause brain damage, particularly in young people. And this is from the New Hampshire Department of Environmental Science, quote, nitrite changes the normal function of hemoglobin, which carries oxygen in the blood, to the rest of the body in a form that is called methemoglobin that can carry oxygen. And dietary nitrites, on the other hand, offer many protective benefits. That's when they're not bound by sodium and not synthesized synthetically. For example, I talk about all the time nitric oxide that you can find in beet juice that regulates blood pressure, boosts immunity, increases blood circulation, aids in wound healing, and improves neurological function. But they're not using that in curing meats. All right? So that's the latest on that. And also for pregnant women, a new study. 40 days and 40 nights since my baby left the town.
Why she left, I just don't know. Forty days and 40 nights since I sat right down and cried. Keep raining all the time, but the river is running dry. Right. I love that girl with all of my heart. 40 days. Sorry for that, but I'm in a storm area right now, and the electricity just went out. I'm filming today, so we've switched over to a land-based line, and I just wanted to let you know that the latest study shows that Tylenol used during pregnancy is associated with an increased risk of autism. So please don't use Tylenol if you're pregnant, because you could end up damaging the developing fetus. And we're going to take a moment and listen to not all of, but a little bit of Chris Hedges, about 5 to 7 minutes of Chris Hedges, before we come back and talk with my guest. Listen up now to Chris Hedges.
That's the thing about being a reporter. They, you know, all this thing of objectivity, this is all crap. What journalists do is manipulate facts. That's what I did for a living.
Did you do that? You did that?
Yes, of course, we all do. The difference is between those of us who cared about the truth and those of us who cared about news, and it's not the same thing. And if you care about the truth, eventually you're going to run into problems.
Chris Hedges is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, activist, and best-selling author who spent nearly 2 decades as a foreign correspondent. 15 of those years, he spent covering some of the most dangerous conflict zones in the world for the New York Times. As a vocal anti-capitalist, he's been a polarizing figure in the mainstream media, which doesn't really matter to him because he thinks mainstream media is full of shit.
Listen, don't take this the wrong way, but you sound like a left-wing nut bar. If you want to discuss issues, that's fine, but, I mean, this sounds like Fox News, and I don't go on Fox News.
In his new book, Wages of Rebellion, Chris looks at how revolution has changed countries and society since the 17th century, and argues that America is next. He recently dropped by our new vice office in Toronto to talk about why America is on the edge of revolt, and how that's maybe not such a bad thing.
So, you're someone who's been shot at by drunk snipers. You've seen death squads in El Salvador. You've seen some pretty dark shit. Do you think that overly informs the way you look at the world?
I wouldn't say overly. I would say that I understand the dark side of human nature because of it. I know what human beings are capable of. I also know how societies disintegrate. I've seen them go down. It's not theoretical for me. So I look around. I mean, you know, because I covered the war in Yugoslavia, I can be in a supermarket and suddenly remember what it looked like when all the windows were smashed out and the shelves were empty and there was no electricity. And I think that's an asset because most people are unable to see the fragility of the structures around them and how easily they can collapse. I think people have lost faith across the political spectrum in neoliberalism. They're not buying it. You know, everything that neoliberalism and globalization supposedly was going to bring us is a lie. It is concentrated wealth into the hands of a global corporate oligarchic elite. It has pushed down wages. It has created chronic unemployment and underemployment. It has eviscerated the middle class. And it has not been a force, as it claims, for democratization. In fact, the opposite. It has been a force that has destroyed civil liberties. The lie is harder and harder to sustain because it's more palpable in the physical conditions around us. You drive through city after city in America, and it's just wasteland after wasteland. Our infrastructure is falling apart. We lie about unemployment figures. I think the LA Times a year or two ago ran a story saying real unemployment is probably about 17%. But even then, half of America, by official statistics, lives in poverty. That's 40,000 per household, which most economists argue is an unrealistic dividing line. But then you add the category of near poverty, which is another. I mean, you're pushing two-thirds of the country. Look, in the United States, we are seeing a rise of very frightening nihilistic violence. School shootings. I think we've had 26 law enforcement officials assassinated. Now, I'm not talking about like gun battles. I'm talking about assassinated.
Guys walking up with guns, shooting
exactly.
While they're parking their cars.
And these are very disturbing signs. And they are examples of people who, I mean, some of them obviously are psychotic and, you know, there are mental issues, but people are breaking down. I mean, you should read, Chomsky points this out, and he's right, read Stacks. This is the guy who flew his Cessna into the IRS building in Austin, Texas. But you should read his manifesto, where he talks about living in a, you know, rundown project, everybody's eating dog food. I mean, that's real. And this kind of mania for hope that is infected even the left is a political pacifier. Everybody is kind of addicted to these happy thoughts. And that keeps us complacent.
So I've been reading Wages of Rebellion. I want to ask you, do you think a revolution could happen in North America?
Well, I hope so. It's all we have left. I think when you look at all of the ingredients that go into creating revolt, the ingredients are there. We are going to have to destroy the system of corporate power by non-cooperation, by obstruction, and by refusing to be fooled by these very clever political carnivals, Canada having just finished one, that cough up these ineffectual figures that are going to do nothing to reverse C-51, which is the very draconian security and surveillance bill, in some ways worse than the Patriot Act. You've got the tar sands. I mean, the Liberal Party is not going to touch that. And in the same way that Obama didn't touch security. It's up to us. And it means acts of sustained civil disobedience. We have a moral imperative to stand up, if not for ourselves, for those who come after. That one revolts finally not for what they can achieve, but for who it allows them to become. And that we can't use the word hope if we don't revolt. If we remain passive, then we are accepting the death sentence that's being handed to us by these corporate forces. There is no way in the American political system to vote against the interests of Goldman Sachs. You can't do it. And so that creates governmental paralysis. The inability on the part of the government to do anything but serve the needs of a tiny cabal, in this case, a corporate cabal.
In other words, people feel like the game is fixed.
But it is fixed. And it's not like they feel like the game is fixed, that they're beginning to know the game is fixed. And once they know the game is fixed, it becomes very dangerous. You know, there are a lot of myths about revolution. They're driven by what Bakunin calls déclassé intellectuals, which is what the Occupy movement was. Highly educated white sons and daughters of the middle class who began to experience what people of color have been experiencing for decades. Unemployment, police repression, foreclosure, all that kind of stuff. And that's why the Occupy movement was an important and a seminal moment in modern history, because it, for the first time, fused those déclassé intellectuals with the underclass. I can only speak about Zuccotti, where I spent a fair bit of time. They lost control of the park once they put up individual tents. That's when you began, sexual assaults came in, drugs came in. We have to remember they were heavily infiltrated.
By the government?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Heavily infiltrated.
You think FBI, CIA?
Completely.
Or?
That's not even a question. Yeah. So, I mean, we have pictures of a few blocks away from Zuccotti, people dressed totally in black as Black Bloc getting out of the back of police vans. I mean, Occupy isn't over. I mean, you know, it isn't over because...
Let me know when you can hear.
Because the state didn't respond rationally to the Occupy encampments. I mean, they closed it down by force. And a rational response would have been a forgiveness of student debt, a massive jobs program, especially targeted to people under the age of 25, a moratorium on foreclosures and bank repossession, and a rational healthcare system that isn't, you know, allowing for-profit corporations to hold sick children hostage while their parents bankrupt themselves trying to save their sons or daughters. That would have been rational. They didn't respond rationally, which means that they're going to get blowback. I mean, people forget Rosa Parks got on that bus in 54. You didn't get the next Freedom Rides till 61. If the state doesn't respond, and it's not responding, then they're going to, this movement's going to continue. Revolt will continue, but it's always the state that determines the configurations of revolt. And the longer the state refuses to respond in a meaningful way, and the state is not responding, then they're going to get blowback. That's
it's
inevitable. There's a passage in Kissinger's memoirs, and no one should ever buy the book, where it's, I think, 1971, and there are, you know, tens of thousands of anti-war protesters surrounding the White House, which is what we have to get back to. And Nixon has taken empty city buses end-to-end and put them all around the White House to protect the White House. And he's looking out the window, wringing his hands, going, Henry, they're going to break through the barricades and get us. And that's exactly where we want all people in power to be. That's our goal.
What would you tell young people who are disenfranchised? What advice can you give them?
Well, I wouldn't give them much advice. I've learned more from a lot of these movements than I've given to them. I mean, you know, my focus is delineating power and how it works and why we can't trust it and why. They get all that because they're victims of it. And you see with the rise of groups like Black Lives Matter, the traditional black elite, Jesse Jackson,
okay, bring him
Al
back.
Sharpton, come to Ferguson. They're booed out of the city, same in Baltimore. They get it. They're not buying Obama. And I teach in a prison.
And that was Chris Hedges. The full interview is on our website. And by the way, I was just informed we had 1,322,000 who've come over just in the last few days. So we have a lot of people coming to get information. And it's good for people all over the world. So we thank you for that. Now let's go out to Washington, D.C., where Alexis Mayer is standing by. Baden Mayer, and I mentioned her bio earlier. She's a Washington-based lawyer and activist serving as the political director for the Organic Consumers Association and its fund. And she's the co-editor of the Organic Consumers Organization's directors, Ronnie Cummings, of its newsletter, Organic Bites, which reaches about 300,000 subscribers. Nice to have you with us today.
Thanks so much, Gary. It's great to talk with you.
We want to take us on a journey of investigating Monsanto for alleged crimes against nature and humanity, because recently we've been seeing reports and financial clues that Monsanto has been getting hit economically on different fronts. Yes, it's a multi-billion-dollar company. And at the start of the year, the company announced it would slash 4,000 jobs. And more countries are coming forth to require the labeling of GMOs or banning GMOs, for example, from schools or for farming. And moreover, global demand for organic produce, including in the U.S., is increasingly steady as more people become aware of GMO risks. And last year, the DARC Act failed in Congress, which would have forbidden GMO labeling. On the other hand, Monsanto and other big agricultural allies are too strong and too powerful and have too much money just to disappear. That's not going to happen. It was reported this week that the Secretary of Agriculture, Tom Vilsack, will meet privately or secretly with Big Ag, Big Food, to perhaps work out a counter-strategy now the Campbell Soup Company has decided to label its products containing GMOs. And finally, your organization, the Organic Consumer Association, in alliance with others, have created a Monsanto tribunal that will weigh in on evidence that Monsanto is a party to crimes against humanity and nature, or perhaps we should say crimes against the environment, because against nature refers to something that simply doesn't exist as such. So this tribunal will convene in The Hague, in the Netherlands, later this year. And of course, to make such charges require substantial evidence. So present your case to us, please.
Thank you, Gary. Well, Monsanto has developed a steady stream of products that are toxic to people and to our planet. The company has pushed genetically modified organisms. They use their technology to collect royalties from poor farmers. They trap farmers in unpayable debt, which is contributing to hundreds of thousands of farmer suicides, you know, in India alone, let alone worldwide. Monsanto's products are responsible for depleting our soil, depleting our water, species extinction, declining biodiversity, the displacement of millions of small farmers worldwide who can no longer farm the soil and no longer have access to water because the industrial model is completely unsustainable.
Okay, well, take us further. Bring us the charges that you believe should be brought against Monsanto to show what the company has been doing that you would question the legality or ethics of it.
Well, that's right. So you mentioned crimes against humanity. Currently, international law recognizes four crimes against peace. We've got crimes against humanity, war crimes, genocide, and crimes of aggression. Now, there is a worldwide campaign to make ecocide the fifth international crime against peace. And the Monsanto Tribunal is a model for how international law can implement this new crime against peace.
Okay, you're evidently familiar with the investigations of Andrew Samsel and Stephanie Sensenov into the documents, almost 20,000 documents, that have been private, that are Monsanto's private experiment documents, and they had to submit the to receive approval for its glyphosate or Roundup use in pesticides. And you may have read our article about this after both were on this program to share how Monsanto has known for over 35 years the serious health effects of and risks of Roundup and its relationship to a wide variety of cancers. How much will this evidence play into or should play into the proceedings?
That's going to be huge. And what this Monsanto tribunal is organized to do is to collect information directly from the people who have been harmed by Monsanto's criminality, including putting products like glyphosate onto the market. Just take the case of Argentina. We have rural communities where glyphosate is sprayed on the soy plantations, but of course not just on the soy plantations. These are genetically modified soy plants that have been engineered to absorb glyphosate, herbicide, Roundup, Monsanto's product. And of course, it gets sprayed all over the schools, all over people's homes. It's aerial sprayed, and you know, then we have horrible cancers and birth defects in these communities that are four times the rate of communities where glyphosate is not sprayed in Argentina. So we can see directly from people's own experiences how Monsanto's crimes impact individuals, communities, and our ability to continue into the future with these forms of agriculture.
I understand that this tribunal is largely symbolic. Even after the Nuremberg trials, the Nazi chemical giant IG Farben was charged with crimes against humanity, yet his top executives charged served only some small amount of jail time and were later released and became top executives and entrepreneurs again for the medical and chemical industries in post-World War II era. So what do you and your colleagues perceive as short and long-term goals for carrying through this tribunal?
Well, this tribunal will be organized exactly like an official international court. And it's not going to be organized and put on just by average people. We'll have very prominent judges and lawyers conducting this case exactly as it would be conducted under international rules of international law by experts in international law. So this court, while it may not be recognized by the UN because ecocide is not yet recognized by the UN, we are demonstrating a model of exactly how it would be done according to the highest standards of international law.
Could you, in just the next 2 minutes we have remaining, could you give us, at least the people in this audience who may not be familiar with, how many problems for the world and for people's health Monsanto has created, like Agent Orange and some of the other chemicals they've created?
Sure. I'll just name a few so that you all can get familiar with this company. Certainly Monsanto markets itself. They actually call themselves a sustainable agriculture company. But in reality, Monsanto is a chemical company. They have developed a steady stream of highly toxic products which have permanently damaged the environment, and they've caused illness and death in thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of people. So just to name a few of this company's products, take PCBs. These are a chemical that are one of 12 persistent organic pollutants that we know, for instance, affect human and animal fertility. They make people infertile. They make it impossible for humans and animals that come into contact with these chemicals to reproduce. It is a very serious toxin. And the reason why they're called persistent organic pollutants is because they never go away. They get into our environment and they just build up. They build up in our environment and then they're absorbed into our bodies or into the bodies of animals and become part of the food chain. And they never go away, so they just accumulate and they have terrible, terrible health effects. Once they're in the environment, we can never get them out. We'll be dealing with the consequences of chemicals like the PCBs that Monsanto created forever. It's on the level of like nuclear waste. It won't go away. So another example of this is the dioxin-containing component of the defoliant Agent Orange. That's 2,4,5-T. This is half of what Agent Orange was made out of. And this is why so many Army veterans who were involved in the Vietnam War, but even more so, the people of Vietnam who live with this chemical to this day and continue to suffer from infertility, birth defects, cancers, just horrible, horrible illnesses in the third generation removed from the Vietnam War when these first chemicals were introduced. Because, as I mentioned, once these chemicals get into the environment, they persist and accumulate, and their toxic impacts can never be, you know, you can't just clean it up. It doesn't go away. I mean, you can certainly do better than we have in trying to clean it up, but once these toxins are in the environment, their effect are long-lasting. And you mentioned Roundup. That's the number one herbicide in the world. The toxin that Monsanto is currently continuing to push through its GMOs. And, you know, they talk about GMOs as a solution to climate change or a way to feed our world's growing population. But Monsanto's GMOs and GMOs in general have never been used for anything but to deliver these pesticides to us more persistently, more effectively. 99.7% of the GMOs that are currently grown in the world today are delivery systems for these toxic herbicides.
I appreciate all the good work that you and Ronnie and all the volunteers at Organic Consumers are doing. OrganicConsumers.org is the website. And my guest, Alexis Baden-Mayer. Alexis, thank you for doing this, and I look forward to the tribunal and the outcome. And even though it is not going to hold them to any legal standard, at least it can be shared with the world of what they've done, and that's what's important.
Thank you so much, Gary. I encourage everyone to go to Monsanto-Tribunal.org, and you can text Join OCA to 97779 to get updates on the trial.
All right. All the best to you. Just a final thought today. This I saw in Tech Swarm by Joshua Krause. 77% of two-year-olds now use mobile devices on a daily basis. 77% of two-year-olds. And clearly, and unfortunately, the parents don't understand the danger of electromagnetic pulses on that developing neurological system. And we're going to see a whole lot of cancers in immune-defective children, because 10 years of exposure from 2 to 12, now they're going to be tipping into disease. That's unfortunate. I am going to be doing an article. It will be out next week, an original in-depth investigative report on cell phones and how dangerous they really are and how much good science is there to prove that they are dangerous, so that at least you'll know. I'm Gary Nall, out on the road, filming all day today. In fact, filming all day tomorrow, too. But you'll appreciate what I'm filming and why I'm doing this once you see the end result on some really powerful, socially relevant themes coming up in the next 2 to 3 months. Have a nice day, everyone.